on Human Services and Housing on March 20th, 2013. What did you say? Okay. I will open up the public hearing on House Bill 2055.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2055 has no revenue impact and a fiscal statement was issued. It extends the sunset on changes to the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you. Let's see, we have people coming to testify. Come on up.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lisa Wendt. I'm the Director of Self-Sufficiency Programs at the Department of Human Services. And today we're here to discuss House Bill 2055, which would continue the suspension of House Bill 2469, which was passed in 2007, designing Oregon's TANF program. So I'll apologize initially for throwing around two bill numbers in the same testimony, but bear with me. Today we'll hit on the highlights of the policies that were addressed in 2469, which ultimately put together best practices to reach the best outcomes for families and children in this state. While many components of the design are still included in the program, several reductions and suspensions had to be implemented beginning in 2009 in order to balance the budget. So for starters, we thought we would address what was actually included in 2469, what some of the early successes were, and then address what some of the changes are moving forward. The strategies employed were research supported and focused a commitment and investment in helping families become self-sufficient. Many of the policy and budget investments recognize that families come to TANF often with more barriers than simply income, whether that be domestic violence challenges, alcohol and drug addiction. And so 2469 really said, let's work with the family to develop a plan that addresses the whole family unit, including income and some of the other supports that were needed. So some of the early pieces that were included in 2469 was the pre-TANF program, the post-TANF program that supported families as they were making that transition to work and recognized that simply going to work gave an income, but there were certain transition supports that were needed during that time. It created the enhanced pre-SSI and SSDI program to help families with disabling conditions apply for and receive SSI. It included job retention payments, and it included a wider range of job support services. So things from the soft skills around helping someone get a job, but also that child care, alcohol and drug treatment, domestic violence services that I mentioned earlier. And it also included enhanced funding for the Family Support and Connections, the Child Abuse Prevention Program. So there were early outcomes in 2007 and 2008 that I wanted to mention. Most significantly, there were almost 1,000 families that were placed in employment compared to the previous year. The federal work participation rate increased by over 9 percentage points compared to the previous year. And the number of families participating in job program activities, both employment and the family stability support, doubled compared to the previous year. Also, by October of 2008, there were over 3,000 employed families receiving the post-TANF support program as well. And early feedback from the clients is that that support really enabled them to purchase either work shoes or tools or uniforms that were tied to their employment. Following the recession and significant budget reductions, and we mentioned this when we were here earlier, but I just wanted to hit on these again, the program's seen a series of cuts from 2009 to today. Clients were impacted in several ways, including the reduction of the post-TANF payments, reduction of access to the services and supports, and that individual support that we know is critical to family success. The governor's recommended budget continues these reductions, so House Bill 2055 makes the statutory language align with what's in the governor's recommended budget. And we have an item, a list here of those particular items. I'll just hit on a couple. Exclusion of enrollment or attendance at an educational institution, so that means the Parents of Scholars program is currently closed except to those already in the program. Maintains a household income limit at 185% of the federal poverty line for caretakers, like grandparents who are taking care of kids, and denial of employment-related daycare for self-employed parents. One of the ways that the jobs program has responded to the reduction in budgets is to look at and assess where families are in their job readiness. So the families, it's a triage approach, if you will. The families that need just a little bit of support are referred to the employment department. There's another set of families who might have a few barriers, and that those folks fall into that near job ready category that you see here. And of the folks that we're currently serving, of just under 1,800 clients are in that job ready category. 1,700 are in job ready, and 161 are in that not job ready. So that's maybe education challenges and other supports that the family really needs to make that transition to work. And it's important to note, as you see here, that we're only serving 15.9% of the TANF mandatory clients given budget challenges. And you'll hear a little bit more in the next bill, I think, about what some of those barriers are and the supports that are needed to help people make that transition to employment. I did want to just mention I was at Central City Concern this morning visiting a couple of their programs and talked to a couple families who are receiving TANF. And some of the pieces that the clients had to share I think were really important to this conversation. Some of the families are in alcohol and drug treatment, and TANF is that only income that they have to support caring for their children and giving them that hope for how they're going to transition from treatment to living on their own, and really conveyed that while TANF is not a huge benefit, it's $506 for a typical family of three, it is the income that really helps that family stay together. When we were here last, we mentioned a series of work groups that the department convened with both department staff and stakeholders. And part of the purpose of those work groups was to look at how can we continue to better our work with families and look for outcomes. And a couple of the items that came out of those work groups were elements that were in 2469, so have some budget attached to them. But some of the strategies also were, could we look at specialized case management for families who are leaving the correction system, for families who have addiction challenges, how can we make sure we're providing them that specialized support for whatever challenge it is that they are facing? Creating a glide path for exiting TANF. So again, that notion of getting a job is a huge step for many families, and helping them make that transition to employment includes looking for housing, taking care of their kids while they're making that transition. So those critical months after maintaining a job, the supports really help make that transition smoother. And I wanted to just mention those, as you're going to hear in House Bill 3440 next, there are some further elements of those ideas that came out of the work groups you're going to hear that are included in that bill and were an important piece to mention today. So in conclusion, we know from the early implementation of House Bill 2469 that the program principles that really address families' needs and looking at the whole family were successful in creating family stability and helping families transition to employment. House Bill 2055 would continue the suspension of the elements that were in 2469. And with that, I'll conclude and answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Whitsitt.
Yes. Does this keep in place the 60-month TANF funding for families, or does it reduce the months allowable to those in the governor's recommended budget?
It maintains the, Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, it maintains 60-month time limit.
Okay, instead of what did the governor recommend? In
the governor recommended 36 months.
As a
and this bill does not address the time limit question.
Okay, and I had one other question, if I could.
You have more questions?
Just one more. Sure. Can an alcohol or drug addict not, who is not in treatment, receive TANF funds?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Sochi Espas. I'm the TANF Program Manager at the Department of Human Services. Representative Whitsitt, the TANF program serves families who meet the eligibility criteria for the program. Especially the House Bill 2469 design, was intended to screen for and identify barriers to employment, which may include addictions issues. So the approach in Oregon and the TANF program in particular is to work with those families families to identify those problems and address them. There is statutory support for mandating treatment as a condition of continued eligibility for the program. So they may receive TANF, but there is an expectation that once an issue is identified that we are working with the family to address the treatment, especially if a qualified and appropriate professional has identified treatment as necessary.
Do we have a time, and do we check up on them for them to go into treatment?
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, each family is different, and each person in their journey to recovery has very specific items in their plan, and so the expectation is that they're maintaining progress. And we work, the intent is for us to work very closely with the experts, the service providers, and Liesl mentioned Central City Concern as being one of those entities who provides this service. So in the Portland area in particular, the caseworkers in the DHS side are working closely with Central City Concern and other service providers.
Thank you.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. Are you able to answer for the employment-related daycare, or are we going to hear from somebody else for that portion of this bill?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, what is your question? We'll do our best, and we can come back with a response.
Okay, thank you. on lines 31, so it's the subsection 8, and then on the second page, lines 1 and 2, subsection 9, put some restrictions on the employment-related daycare program, which personally I hate to see in statute. I'd love to leave more flexibility and leave that to the budget and see if we can restore some of that. Denying employment-related daycare assistance to a parent who is self-employed, I know that's been a big issue in the past, refers to often people who have their own house cleaning services or offer daycare to other people, things like that, and then eliminating the reduced copay required. These are issues that have been contentious in the past. I kind of hate to lock them up into statute, and then there's no flexibility over those in the next 2 years. So I didn't know if you were able to address that.
Chair Tomei and Representative Kenny Geyer, one of the pieces, this isn't a direct answer to your question, but there are a couple other amendments that we need to bring back to align the language here with the budget, and that could be one way to address that issue, is as conversations progress.
And you could maybe meet offline about that amendment?
That would be great. And follow up to
follow
that.
Up?
That was more around the employment-related daycare in the previous part of the bill, which is more around TANF. Is there anything in there that restricts us statutorily to some of the cuts that we've made in the last few years? I understand some of the reining things in, but they didn't seem to refer to what you were talking about in terms of loss of TANF jobs and other kinds of supports. Is there anything in here that statutorily restricts us toward the programs that you talked about having been cut over the last few years?
Mm-hmm. Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, and I can't remember if Ms. Wendt mentioned this, but we will be
from the mic a little bit.
We will be likely working with Legislative Council to amend the bill to include additional areas that are not reflected. This bill was first requested by the department as a placeholder bill, and it predates the GRB release. I think your point is well taken around particularly the jobs program, and there may be some areas that we might be able to work with Legislative Council on to be more specific.
Madam Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, I think if you wait to hear what 3440 has, because it's got the work group that worked on this the last year has a lot of the components, and I think what you're interested in. And then also for your information, our speaker worked very hard on this whole thing 7 years ago, to get us to where we're at right now. And I mean, there was she did some real carving. I mean, that group back then even did a tonful of work on this whole thing to get it where we felt comfortable with it right now. So, just for information.
Thank you.
Did you have further questions? Great. Any other questions?
Thank you very much. And we have Patty Whitney Wise and Marcia Kelly.
Thank you very much, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. I'm Patty Whitney Wise, the director of the Oregon Hunger Task Force, and we're here in support of the suspension of 2055. You might think differently because we, of course, worked very hard on passing that bill to begin with, and I just want to reiterate that the suspension rather than elimination means that it gives us the ability to bring it back as the program was, or at least those components that have been identified as most beneficial. So we are working on a number of strategies with the budget committees as well and recognize this as a placeholder, but certainly would prefer the suspension to elimination of those programs and then adding them back as possible. Part of the reason for putting in place this new TANF program that we did back in 2007 is that we recognized as a task force we aren't going to end hunger in Oregon until we make sure that families are stable. And we need to find good ways to help them make that transition from not being in the workforce or being in poverty to a better place where they can provide for their families and move forward and up. So this bill back in 2007 was designed to remove barriers, provide appropriate skills training, and move people into the workforce with the supports they needed to be successful. And as you heard from Liesl, it was beginning to have really good impacts. An additional, not just 1,000 families, but an additional 1,000 families over the prior year were placed in jobs. And there were other categories created. So some people really were not able to work. They really should have been getting Social Security Income, SSI, and they were put into that program. So that was successful. So we were identifying the families who needed the alcohol and drug treatment and making sure they got those services up front so that they were then ready to move into the workforce, not just trying to move them into the workforce before they could really hold down a job. So all of those things were very successful, and the recession got in the way a bit. I will say, though, that our biggest concern in not restoring funding to this program is what the impacts are on the health care reform and the early learning reform that are going on in our state. So if families are less stable, they tend to get sick more and end up in the emergency room more, and that's a cost that the whole healthcare transformation is trying to bring down. We need to make sure that these families are on a trajectory to be successful so that the healthcare initiative is successful. And you can make the same parallel with the early learning initiative. If families are unstable, it makes it really hard for a child to go to school and concentrate. If they don't have secure housing, if they don't have enough food to eat, they have a much harder time learning. We have this goal of every child being ready in kindergarten and reading by third grade. We are not going to reach that goal with many of these families unless we make sure that we've helped them move up the ladder into stability, into jobs, in a more stable environment for those children to really succeed. So this program really ties into those other major initiatives in the state, and I think that the cuts of the last 4 years have been very hard in this way. And this is on top of eligibility slipping year after year. People have to be poorer every year even to get onto the program. So we believe that targeted add-backs would really help to boost family stability, and you'll hear a little bit more in the next bill that is going to be up. Either way, with this program, I would request this committee consider establishing a work group in the interim to really look at how TANF connects to both the healthcare and the early learning initiatives and what the pieces are to really make those families successful so that the rest of our state initiatives are successful as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patty. Any questions of Patty before we move on? Thank you.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I'm Marcia Kelly with the American Association of University Women. I'm a public policy advocate. We've been long involved in this program, having lobbied along with lots of others to get the parents as scholars as part of the program. And now it's only available to those who were in the program at the beginning of 2009, if there are any of those even left. But that's one of the reasons why we're willing to do the suspension of the program as it is now and work towards some other things as add backs, hopefully, in the other bill. But one of the things that we really strongly believe in, and unless you give families really good support to be able to get to their full potential and working, we're doing a disservice to the children who are in their families. This bill, as a retention of the program but not implementing the program elements, is really important to keep on the books so that we can, when things are better, really, as Patty said, take a look at those bills. I remember the many times I went to Portland to various places where the advocates were meeting and saying, okay, now what have you found out about the best practices in this area? There were long and very good conversations around that before 2469 happened, and so we don't want to lose everything that we have as 2469. I didn't sign up again on the next bill because, of course, if I want to have more in the program so that we really can stabilize families as much as possible. But just remember that right now we're only serving 16% of the clients in the jobs program, and the need is there. So whether we can get we need to get additional funding, or we're going to continue to have the problems that we have with our families.
Thank you, Marcia. Any quick questions? Thank you very much for coming to testify. I think that's all we have who have signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2055 and open up the public hearing on House Bill 3440.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3440 has no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact, but the statement has not been issued yet. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It establishes the total aid paid to families during single periods of eligibility during the calendar year 2013 at $1,000. It requires the Department of Human Services to provide employment retention assistance to families receiving TANF services. It clarifies suitable activities for employed caretaker relatives, and it modifies the time period and calculation for families to receive aid. It contains an emergency clause effective upon passage.
Thank you.
You want me to stand up and swear in
yes,
first?
Yes, please.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative from the Albany area. And thanks for the opportunity to share in front of you with House Bill 3440. There's a group behind me that will be coming up sharing a lot more about this than what I know, but TANF has always kind of interested me, especially since the 07 session and the bill that we just heard considering the sunset. You know, I found that very interesting to see what was going on for what's happening out there for families that really need the help with things. So basically, all I'm going to do here with 3440 is share three components that we kind of, you know, I learned about what this bill does. The first part is obviously the pre-TANF part, and you're going to hear that as it's described. The second part to it is really the retention services side of it. That's your child care, the budget portion of it, as well as life decisions too for us being involved in it. And some of that, if you look at the Dash 1 amendments, and we'll kind of explain that a little bit to you too, addresses this. And then the third part, which I really like, is the post-TANF part, and it's a graduated piece that's designed to try to ensure, one, that when somebody gets toward the end, we help them get off at a point and a level that makes them feel comfortable. But look, I mean, it's time, let's it's time to move on. Let's get you going, you know, and have that locked in. And I think that's a good selling piece for me. A number of you on this committee have signed on to this bill. I greatly appreciate that. But I'm going to stop at this point. That gives you really a quick nutshell version of what this bill does. And then, obviously, Patty Whitney Wise and John and some others will be filling in the gaps for me.
Thank you very much, Representative. I just want to remind the committee, we heard testimony from a couple of weeks ago about someone who had been on TANF, and then she got a job, and she was taken off TANF, and she wasn't able to succeed in her job because she didn't have any of the benefits. She didn't get paid for a couple of weeks, so she had to go back on TANF because she didn't have any cash to live on and pay her rent and buy groceries. So I think that's an important component of post-TANF. Thank you. Any quick questions before we hear from the really smart people? Okay. are we taking these in order, Representative? Yeah. They've written down?
Yes.
Okay. Allison McIntosh, John Mullen, and Jessica Cheney. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing me to testify today. For the record, my name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm the Policy and Communications Director for Neighborhood Partnerships. I'm here today to speak in support of House Bill 3440 and its Dash 1 amendments, which would restore services and make improvements to the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF, is designed to protect families with children and to help them meet their basic needs. It solves problems by providing a small level of cash assistance plus supportive services to help remove barriers and help families return to employment. Right now, families are struggling to survive, facing choices like paying rent or buying food and medicine. Our basic safety net programs are a life raft for kids and families, and we need to make sure that temporary assistance is available for families and help them get back on their feet. Since 2011, as you've heard in the previous discussion, the TANF program has experienced cuts, which have made it difficult for families to receive the services they need to return to employment. The Department of Human Services and its employees and community partners have done their best to make the program work with limited resources. However, it's often not been enough to help families succeed. In the summer of 2011, the Department of Human Services invited advocates, staff, and contractors to participate in a series of work groups to discuss ways to improve the TANF program. They set up three work groups, one of which discussed the pre-TANF program eligibility and assessment, one of which discussed the ongoing TANF program, and one which discussed post-TANF, leaving TANF, and returning to employment. The work groups discussed and prioritized innovative ideas and solutions. This bill, House Bill 3440, with its Dash 1 amendments, takes three ideas from those work groups that we believe will make a significant difference for families. First, it restores and adds into statute a pre-TANF program. The program is designed to help families who would be eligible for TANF, but if they were given a small amount of assistance, might be able to return to work immediately without entering the program. And John Mullen will be speaking more to this idea and concept. Second, it requests that the department and its contractors offer services for families to help them transition to work. That could include helping families plan for transportation or childcare or other needs as they return to work. And lastly, it restores post-TANF, a program which was implemented through House Bill 2469 in 2007, and makes a small change. The original post-TANF program was a 12-month flat grant for families. It was $150. This new iteration, as Representative Olson indicated, is a stair-step-down approach over a shorter period of time. And Jessica Cheney will speak to both of those concepts. These positive changes, plus reinvestment in other areas of the program, will truly help make this program a one that protects families and solves problems by helping families address barriers and return to employment. We urge your support of House Bill 3440 with its Dash 1 amendments. And thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Allison. I think we'll hear from the whole panel and then we'll get to questions.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, and very happy to have this opportunity. I want to start out by commenting on the previous bill just briefly by putting it in context by saying that, as some of you are aware, I was involved in the work group on 2469 in the 2007 session, and actually four members of this committee were involved on the committee at that point in time. And what was so exciting about that is that we worked together to take a look at how the program could be made Oregon's program from the time welfare reform passed. We had a program from 96 on that was really basically following the federal guidelines, but we hadn't really talked about how we wanted to improve it and make it ours. And in 2007, 2469 did that. The reason I want to mention that in the context of pre-TANF is that pre-TANF is one of the ideas that emerged in that work group. We said if we looked at this whole thing, the services as a continuum, where people are, what their needs were, and trying to help them at that time and get them in the right direction, one of the ways of thinking about pre-TANF is sort of like the front porch of a program. In other words, it doesn't necessarily mean people need to come in, but they need to get some assistance there on the front porch. People can be in all sorts of difficult circumstances and be very low income, but maybe really don't need an ongoing program to help them over a period of time. They may be job ready at that time. So the key for pre-TANF is making sure that we're doing proper assessment on that front porch. In other words, if somebody is not going to be job ready, let's get them into the TANF program. But if somebody has a problem with rent or a car is broken down, let's go ahead and help them. Now, pre-TANF was working quite well, but as the cuts to the program happened over time, there were two things that happened with pre-TANF that made it a program that's not very usable. First of all, there was restrictions on the dollar amounts that that could be used, and in addition to that, there were restrictions on what the dollars could be used for. So, for example, shelter and utility payments were no longer eligible, and so that made the pre-TANF program that we have now, what's the remnants of it, not very usable. And the work group really understood that we could make some improvements to that program by making some changes. And the support service changes that are talked about and are also a little bit changed in the Dash 1 amendments narrow the numbers of people that would actually be eligible for this, but basically really makes it a flexible program and it restores dollars to the program to help make it successful. As advocates, sometimes I think committee members may wonder about what our interests are, and I think that it's fair to say that no matter where you stand on this, the issue of temporary assistance for needy families, we all want to see smaller caseloads. We want to see people be able to be successful, be independent on their own and all that. And so pre-TANF is one of those tools that make it better and easier for case managers to assess properly and then say, what really you need is some short-term assistance. We're here to do that for you. And so that's what the change about pre-TANF is about.
Thank you, John.
Hi. For the record, my name is Jessica Cheney. I work for Partners for Hunger Free Oregon. I'm also the co-chair on the Family Services Review Commission, a governor's commission that is in an advisory role to the Department of Human Services. A few weeks ago, I came before you and shared my story, and I think it was referenced a little bit earlier in terms of I am the I was going to say infamous, but I don't like that word as applied to me. poster child. I am the person who ended up quitting a job while I was on TANF, while coming off of TANF, because I could not bridge that gap in time between my benefits ending and my first paycheck. And I just wanted to expand a little bit about what that time was like, because it leads into House Bill 3440, and I think it kind of helps explain why some of the components are in there. I had just completed a six-month training program. Prior to that, there was a DH-sponsored program, and I was pretty excited about being in that program because it gave me hope. It made me feel like I was on a track to something. And I think most of all, it made me feel like I was going to get back to this place of having a normal life. I had been in the military before I went on TANF, before I got out of the military and went on TANF, and was used to a higher income, being able to support my kids. This was a really tough time for me, and I wanted to get back to that place. So I really grabbed onto that program. I attended every day. In fact, I had a perfect attendance certificate that I was, kind of sounds silly, but at those moments in your life, these kinds of things matter. And I felt like I had a partnership with DHS, like we were both on the same track. They wanted me to get employment. I wanted to get employment. I was in this program. Everything was good. Until it got to that place where I actually got a job. That was exciting in and of itself. However, that was the point in time when I realized that there was no help between the time that I went off of assistance and the first paycheck arrived. And it was going to be about 3 weeks. And having children as young as I had and no money at all and having lots of back bills in addition to that, it was, and no credit cards. My mother, who was disabled and low income herself, there was no resources to draw upon. And so I quit my job and I went back on to TANF. I will say that it was pretty depressed at that point in time because I felt like I didn't know how I was going to get off the program. I mean, this is my shot. It didn't work, so what next? So that was kind of a really tough time for me, mentally speaking. The other thing was that I was angry. I was really angry at DHS because I felt like they put out an expectation, and yet they didn't allow me to fulfill it. It just didn't make sense to me, you know, why the program was designed the way it was. In hindsight, you know, I understand now that anger was misplaced because they did not have the tools. Like John was saying, you need these tools. They did not have the tools in place to help me. So even though my caseworker may have wanted to give me transitional benefits, she was not allowed to. So it was really the policies that were in place that were creating this situation. So that is why I'm so excited about House Bill 3440. And I'm really excited to have been a part of the group that kind of helped put that together and very appreciative of Representative Olson and others who have joined in this effort as well. The three components I think are extremely important, like John said, to help prevent people from coming on the program that really don't need to be on the program and perhaps don't want to be. I mean, it wasn't a great source of pride for me to be on the program. I did it because I had to. That's what I need to do to survive and support my children. The other thing that I think is really important is that it allows for the payment of rent and utilities, which is not currently in place. I mean, those are two of the primary reasons that a family would need that type of assistance. And effectively, caseworkers, their hands are tied. They can't help. The retention services, I think, are extremely important. When we were in our work groups and talking about the design, some of the ideas that were on the table, one person mentioned who worked in District 2, he said, you know, a long time ago we used to have retention services, and what they noticed from that process that there were three kind of types, so to speak, of clients that took advantage. They saw three kind of situations that happened as clients exited the program. One was the kind of leave me alone, I'm gone, I'm out of here, I don't want to be left alone, I don't want anything to do with this program. Then there were those that appreciated periodic support, kind of the check-in, somebody to go to if something was wrong. It was kind of a light touch, so to speak. And then there was another third group of people that really needed a lot of hand-holding, needed support and assistance. They were isolated. Perhaps they didn't have a lot of good role models or supports in their families. And so having that caseworker be available to offer them that kind of support was really important. The other piece that's really exciting about this bill is that stair-step approach off of TANF. And I realize the other post-TANF program was beneficial for many families in terms of adding a little bit of extra assistance once a month. But I do feel like a richer benefit for a shorter period of time would really be helpful. For instance, in my case, where I needed that time to both have the income from the job, but also having that additional TANF benefit to pay off some of those back bills. Because I could not pay every bill every month. So there was always a late notice for several of my bills. It was the car insurance, the utilities, the water. You know, you played this juggling game every single month. So having that TANF grant on top of your employment, at least a portion of it for a period of time, allows you to pay down those bills and then get on a more financial footing so that you're more successful in that job. So I'm very excited about this proposal, and I really do think if implemented, it could have some great success. And I hope that you agree and will support this bill as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, any questions of any of these witnesses? Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chairperson. John, you kind of indicated that this was a Oregon model, and I do want to express appreciation. I think it's a great concept and appreciate my colleagues on the committee who have contributed to this concept. My question has to do with, as a sort of a secondary prevention effort, and certainly looks like it would help to streamline and provide some efficiency to the system. Are there other models, as is in nationally, where this and have they done any kind of cost-benefit analysis to show their outcomes?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, one of the things we did in the work groups is we took a look at research and we looked at models in other states. And I can't cite chapter and verse, but certainly the department has a number of those studies. And we took a look at some of those things and say, well, how would those kinds of things fit in the way we do business in Oregon? And so we did borrow a little bit here and there, or at least we bounced ideas off of what other states are doing. Some other states do some things that I wish we did here, which is that the standard of need, I'm probably using an old term here, but would allow more people to be in the workforce while their TANF benefits would stay in place, at least until they reached a certain level of income. Here in this state, if you get any kind of a job at all, you're pretty soon quickly off of TANF. So there are policy decisions that other states have made that we looked at, but we said, well, here in Oregon, here are the conditions that we have right now. Here's the best that we can learn from other states. But frankly, a lot of the discussion, even as we looked at that research, came back to our thinking about when we made it Oregon's program back in 2007. And while we couldn't get all the way back there, what are the smart investments we could make to make it as good as possible?
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. We have Rachel Post, Patty Whitney Wise, and Philip Kennedy Wong. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rachel Post, and I am a licensed clinical social worker. I am also the public policy advisor at Central City Concern in Portland, Oregon. I'm here today to support House Bill 3440 and its Dash 1 amendments. I'm also here to talk a little bit more about the support services component or the jobs component of the TANF program. We were asked not to include that in the bill because it would have an impact on the budget. So I'm here today to ask you to protect children and families as they take steps towards a more stable life and ask you to restore $10 million of funding to support services such as child care and transportation for families receiving TANF. A fully funded TANF program is critical to breaking the cycle of poverty, assisting Oregonians to transition to jobs, supporting healthy development of young children, and keeping families stable. For families served through Central City Concern's continuum of integrated health care and supported affordable housing, the TANF program has contributed to the return of hundreds of children from foster care. For the three-year period prior to the cuts to the job program, we saw 292 children returned from the foster care system to our families. In the 12-month calendar year after the cut, we saw only 48 children returned from foster care. These cuts have created a log jam for families who would otherwise be able to exit treatment, our affordable supported housing, and the TANF program, except for the fact that they do not have the child care and transportation needed to look for and find employment. While the average cost of our service continuum, including treatment, housing, and employment placement, is $12,000 per year per family, the alternative, foster care, costs $33,000 per year per child. Some of our families are seeing 2 to 3 children return from foster care once they've secured housing. The math here clearly supports the fiscally sound decision I ask you to make, which is to restore $10 million of funding to the self-sufficiency program. Child care is also a critical building block for family success, and the lack of child care that resulted from the cuts made in 2011 is proving devastating to families. Without child care, children and adults face overwhelming obstacles to making positive change in their lives and are accessing other more costly systems, such as jails and prisons, emergency rooms, and homeless shelters. These more costly systems also can result in greater exposure to adverse childhood experiences that are now documented to lead to chronic
and costly health conditions later in life. A fully funded TANF program can help ameliorate the length and degree of exposure to trauma, poverty, homelessness, deprivation that children face when families experience hard times. At Central City Concern, like so many of the other human service agencies across our state, we know what works for families facing difficult times. Nearly 80% of those families who come through our continuum of integrated healthcare, affordable housing, move on to their own permanent housing with their families fully intact, clean and sober, and self-sufficient. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair and members of the committee, for record, Philip Kennedy Wong on behalf of Oregon Food Bank. I want to start by thanking Representative Olson for his leadership on TANF, as well as the rest of the committee members, because many of us have actually met and talked with you about the importance of the TANF program. I want to take a brief moment to talk about the tact that Oregon Food Bank sees TANF. Obviously, we all know that hunger has increased dramatically in the state.
Did you say your name?
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yes.
You did. Okay, thank you.
So, obviously, we've seen hunger increase in the state of Oregon. I wanted to share with you a result from one of our surveys, which I shared with you probably not too long ago, but it bears repeating. So we distributed 81 million pounds of food for the last 2 years. We'll be distributing another 80 million pounds of food this current year. And that roughly equates to about over a million emergency food boxes. And according to our surveys, about a third of those households receiving emergency food services are households with children. And it's shocking and alarming for many of us when you take a look at, the wealth that we have in our state. But having said that, I do want to share just a few things about the TANF program. It really is about about the child. It's about keeping children healthy, and that's why Food Bank does what it does. But it can't do it alone. We can't afford to continue to feed people without having a program like TANF that can help families, in our view, become better parents by being able to remove some of the barriers that parents might come across. I know that some folks weren't so fortunate, might have been born in a family where the circumstances were less than desirable and may have, as a result, later in their lives, have made decisions that have led to where they're at. But it also is a program for parents who, through no fault of their own, have come across situations such as the economy, finding themselves needing to have help. So with that said, we believe that we do have a TANF program that works. The unfortunate thing, obviously, as some of you know who have been here through the years, that there have been so many cuts to this program, and which is why House Bill 3440 is important, because it helps, I think, put the TANF program back where it needs to be. As the program stands now, from our perspective, it seems like we are in danger of actually setting parents to set them up to fail because of the fact that we don't have the retention services, we don't have some of the support services such as the child care and transportation, so that a parent can get to things like counseling if they have drug addictions, or they have a job interview, or they need to take some of the required job training classes. If they don't have some of those support services, then they're not going to be successful. So with that said, I do encourage you to pass this bill, and this sort of ends my testimony, and be more happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Patty Whitney Wise, Oregon Hunger Task Force. We're in support of House Bill 3440. The information you heard about child care and transportation aren't specifically in this bill. We were advised that those are budget items, so we'll be sharing that more fully with the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, and we hope that your committee will express those concerns and interests as well. So just to wrap up, House Bill 3440 provides some modest but very targeted and important improvements to the program that will help our families get back to work and be successful. And in addition, we'll be asking for some additional funds in the Ways and Means Committee to help with that critical child care and transportation. One of the things Rachel didn't say is that really TANF is just a little piece of what they're able to put together from other federal and city and county funds, private funds, and that little bit makes the difference in helping those families succeed. So the return on investment in this kind of targeted additions to TANF make a huge difference because it helps all those communities already have the other pieces in place succeed with their families. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patty. Any questions from anyone on the panel? All right. Thank you very much. I think that's all the people who have signed up to testify on this piece of legislation. Thank you for coming to testify, folks. Thank you, Representative Olson, for working on this legislation. And with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3440. And we are going to open up the House Bill 3007. And I know there are people in hearing room D, and so I think they can see us on television, right? And so, okay. Go ahead, Regina.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3007 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. It directs owner of residential facility to offer tenants opportunity to purchase facility before owner offers sale of facility to third party. It establishes a process for tenants to purchase facility.
Thank you very much. Okay. So I think we have Representative Nathanson. Is she here? There she is. And John Van Landingham and Pat Swatch. And could everybody be sure your cell phones are turned off, please? Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from House District 13. In 2007, we passed legislation allowing residents of manufactured home parks to form associations or co-ops to purchase their park so they could remain in their home and keep their neighborhood intact. In 2009, we added meaning to that action, giving them a crack at buying the park. In short, an owner must notify the residents of an intent to sell and give time to the residents to come up with an offer to buy the park. If they can match the offer, their offer must be considered first. The owner is able to sell in either case, but this added a tool to help keeping existing neighborhoods intact and prevent the loss of some of Oregon's most affordable housing. We know that the existing statute, again, we passed it in 2009, we know that that existing statute is imperfect, and both the residents and park owners would benefit from clarifying the process and putting some sideboards on it. There are 63,133 manufactured or mobile home spaces in these parks in Oregon. Nearly 900 of those are in my district in North Eugene. This is affordable housing that already exists. Let's not lose it. Most seniors in parks expect that this will be their final home, and they plan accordingly. Some of the residents are the working poor. Others are often vulnerable, medically vulnerable, or financially. The residents often share a strong sense of community. The social network is strong and supportive, helping people who may struggle without that network. Low-income families, disabled or elderly persons. When a park is closed and converted to another use, a neighborhood, a community, is wiped out. Moving the home is often not an option because they are unable or it is no longer suitable to be moved or there is no place to move their home to. Since 1997, there have been at least 68 park closures in Oregon for a loss of 2,713 spaces. But we've also seen mobile home parks preserved. Since 2006, 7 parks were purchased by a homeowner co-op or a nonprofit organization like St. Vincent de Paul. And that helped preserve 294 affordable homes. Under current law, a developer can make an offer on a park and the landlord can agree and the park can be closed and cleared a year after giving notice. What happens to those residents? It's hard to say, but we can reasonably say that many of the most vulnerable residents who depended on neighbors for help, help with daily living, groceries, picking up the mail, we know that some of those will be unable to relocate their home to another park, and unable to find suitable housing with that social network and will end up moving into nursing homes or assisted living facilities. That's at great cost to their happiness, a cost to their health, and it ends up being an additional cost to the state as they move into some other kind of long-term supported care. In just one example, 297 tenants were displaced in 2008 when the Thunderbird Home Park closed in Wilsonville. Based on conversations with just one caseworker, three of those residents went from receiving in-home care in their mobile home park at an average yearly cost to the state of $5,000 per person to moving to an assisted living facility at more than double the cost. Was $11,000 annually. And those figures add up quickly. Again, that was just one caseworker working with just three of the residents from that park. We say we value home ownership. We're talking about home ownership here, but they are tenants on land that someone else owns. We should be prepared not only to encourage home ownership, but to step in and help people keep the homes they already own and keep them in the neighborhoods in which they live. Moving is often not a viable option, either financially or logistically. When Oregon first started legislating to help mobile home park tenants, and remember, they're tenants of the property, those homes were mobile. In the intervening decades, those mobile homes aged and the structures weakened. Building codes have changed and the manufactured home industry grew. The affordable homes that are now built in a factory are moved to a site. Many of the older and newer mobile and manufactured homes are really not movable any longer. Even if the home was movable, there may be no place to move it to. Preserving affordable housing is far less expensive than developing new affordable housing. This bill simply gives the tenants the opportunity to work together to keep their homes and preserve their neighborhoods. The cost of having so many people displaced becomes more of a burden for the state. It has the potential to cost the state a significant amount to put displaced tenants in new low-income housing or to support the cost of uprooted residents when they enter nursing homes. This bill will help preserve neighborhoods and save money. I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any quick questions of Representative Nathanson?
Are you planning on staying after John?
Or I can stay around.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I might have some questions,
Great.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead. John?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Van Landingham. I work as a lawyer for Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center in Eugene. I've been there for 35 years. I've worked on manufactured home park legislative issues for almost 20 years. That's right. It's been a long time and a lot of fun. I'm the drafter of HB 3007. Representative Nathanson is the champion of House Bill 3007. I want to note, in terms of our careers, that we started on the Eugene Planning Commission together in 1988 or 89, I think, and she has obviously gone on to better things than I have. Questionable. I'm also a board member of an organization called Manufacturers Housing Oregon State Tenants Association, which is a statewide organization that represents park tenants. Before I begin with the substance, I want to encourage you to look at a couple of things that are in your electronic packet. I've provided written testimony outlining the bill. I'll walk through that so that you can understand it. It's a complicated issue, and I think that part of the opposition reflects that it is complicated and people don't understand what it tries to do or what it is proposing to do. The second thing is a document of mine, comparing or showing you what the existing law is. You are not being asked to write on a blank slate. There is already Oregon law about this subject, and it's not very good for either side. It's an important point to keep in mind. If you do nothing, that bad law stays on the books. And then lastly, I'd like you to, I think there's a letter in there from Patricia Schwack. She was afraid to come today because she's in her late 80s. She has limited lung capacity, and she's worried about getting the cold, which I have gotten, as many others in the building have gotten, and I urged her not to come. But she is in full support. She has been the tenant champion for the last 20 years on these issues, and she's in support of this bill. And then I'd also ask you to look at a letter from a woman named Tammy Kaufman. who is a city councilor in Gold Beach, a self-described conservative, who manages a park where the residents have bought the park. Her family owns another park, and she lives in a park in Gold Beach. So this is somebody with a unique perspective on this issue. So again, thank you for hearing the bill. Let me start by explaining what the bill attempts to do, and that's the outline I've given you of HB 3007. And rather than go through it section 1, section 2, section 3, I'm going to try to do it in what I think is logical fashion. And in my handout, I've referred you to the sections of the bill. So if you want to check to make sure that I haven't got something wrong, you can go to that section and see where what I'm saying is.
Madam Chair, can we please, which is John's testimony, which is...
And I have hard copies if that would help, too.
Let us know. We've got about 20...
I'm a hard copy person.
Yeah, sure.
We've got about 20 things here.
We've gotten at least 20, yeah. It's the best. You have this. John will hand it to you. Anybody else need a hard copy?
Yep.
Representative Whitsitt would like a copy.
Me too.
And Representative Olson.
Yes, I do.
Thank you for bringing me, John. We're not all as computer savvy as we wish we were.
Yeah.
Okay, there we go. Thank you.
I made 30 copies, so there should be extras for the audience. So, some in the audience.
Debbie, we need the copies of John's.
That's what she's doing.
I'm doing it right here.
Just John's right now. And then you can pass the others out later. If you would. I've got one. That's okay. Thank you. And Representative Whitsitt would like one. Anybody else over there?
Mm-hmm.
So again, there should be two. One of them at the top says outline of HB 3007. The other one says, sort of partway down the page, current Oregon law.
Okay, got it.
Okay, so again, what I'm trying to do here is outline for you what is in 3007, because it is dense and complicated. First, what it does is say that a landlord or a park owner or a marina owner, this applies to floating home marinas as well, who wishes to sell that park must offer the residents of the park an opportunity to compete to purchase the park. An opportunity to compete to purchase the park. Unless the owner has an unsolicited offer before this to buy the park. That is a hugely insignificant exception. When we've been negotiating this issue for more than 3 years, more than about 20 drafts in the Manufactured Housing Landlord Tenant Coalition, and one of the first concerns landlords raised was, if I get an unsolicited offer from a 1031 exchange buyer, somebody who's got IRS tax pressures to buy some other real estate quickly, I need to act quickly or that buyer's going to walk. That buyer also is probably going to pay you top dollar because they have an incentive to reinvest in real estate. So what we've done is say, if you get a buyer like that, you are excluded from this requirement. You do not have to deal with the tenants at all. You can take that offer right now. That's my second point in this memo, and that's in section 5, sub 3. So if you get a truly unsolicited offer, that doesn't mean that you get to go out and ask people to give you an unsolicited offer. That's soliciting an offer, which apparently happens in Florida with parks there. Florida has a similar law. But if you get a truly unsolicited offer where, and that was happening before the crash, where people who were selling real estate had a lot of money and were cold calling park owners around the state and offering them a lot of money. That was one of the things that drove the park closure crisis in the mid-2000s. Third point here is, though, if you don't have an unsolicited offer and you simply decide you want to sell your park, that's your right. Absolutely. And what we're asking is that you allow the tenants, the residents of the park, an opportunity to compete to buy that park. And what you have to do is give them that opportunity. There's no prohibition during this period on the landlord soliciting other offers. And if the landlord gets a better offer during this period, great. The landlord can use that better offer to tell the tenants, this is an offer I've got. And if you can't beat that offer, that I'm going to say no to you, and I'm going to take that offer when the time comes. The fourth point here, that starts off by saying that the landlord has to give a notice. That's actually my third point. But so the fourth point there in my memo is that that notice has to say to the tenants, and they get a 30-day period to do certain things. The other thing we've done in this bill to try to address the landlord's concern about delay is to set it up in stages. So there's an initial 30-day stage. If the tenants don't do the requirements in the first 30-day stage, deal's off. There's no obligation to do anything. You get to go, if you're a landlord, you get to go ahead. If they do meet those obligations in the first 30 days, at the bottom of page one, they've got to give the landlord a written notice saying they're interested.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Mr. Van Lingenham, what if someone comes in with a 1031 during this 30 days?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, they are going to have to ride through this process, but they can take that 1031 exchange offer and use that to evaluate the tenant's eventual offer. If the tenants eventually make an offer, then and they've got a better offer from the 1031 exchange buyer, but you're right. If a 1031 exchange buyer comes in during that 30 days or during the 50-day period that we've got here, and they're not willing to wait, then that 1031 buyer is not going to the landlord's going to have to wait for the tenant process.
Okay, Madam Chair.
That's a drawback.
You're saying the 30 days after. If we don't have the 1031 before he gives a notice to the owners, and then that 30-day notice stops any other sale till you're going to tell us what else happens during the process.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisdom, I'm going to try to tell you what else is going to happen. But it is true that if there's no unsolicited offer, the idea here is that the provisions of Section 4 of the bill apply, and the landlord has to give the tenants an opportunity to try to purchase. If there is an unsolicited offer, then the deal is off. Section 5 applies. In Section 4, the tenants have 30 days from the landlord's notice to give written notice of their interest, designate one or more representatives to negotiate, form a corporate entity, or associate with a consultant, and then finally incur some cost in evaluating the park. In other words, making a movement towards figuring out what the park is worth to compete to buy it. Okay.
We're going to hold further questions until after he's through this presentation.
Sorry.
Go ahead. That's fine.
The fifth point in my outline of the bill is that if the tenants make a written request, the landlord is required to give them what's called a broker's package, in which the landlord would describe certain things. The purchase price the landlord wants, the asking price, the 3 years of income and expense data, 5 years of capital improvements, the capitalization rate if the landlord knows it, and the current vacancies. There's no requirement that that data be tied to any space. One of the landlord's concerns has been that, tenant in space number 100 can now find out what tenant in space number 101 is paying. There's no requirement that it be tied to the spaces, but the tenants have to understand what it costs to operate that park. If they can't understand that, then how can they evaluate the price? This is the same data that a park owner would give to any buyer and do give to any buyer. And we're not requiring that they spend any money preparing this data. But if you've made a decision, and again, remember, this only applies if you've made a decision to sell your park. If you've made a decision to sell your park, then you're going to need this data for any buyer, and you should give that to the tenants. An owner can require the residents to treat that data as confidential forever. If the tenants violate that obligation, the deal's off. Landlord doesn't have to comply with requirements of it. I'm working through my memo, by the way, so I'm now on point number 7. If the residents fail to do the things required in that 30-day period, the deal's off. No further obligation on the landlord. Point number 8. After that first 30-day period, the tenants have another 20 days, for a total of 50 days at this point, to submit a written purchase offer and get the landlord to agree. So that's 50 days. 30 plus 20 is 50. I'm hearing someone in the audience whisper. So that's the amount of time that they have to reach an agreement with the landlord, and there's no obligation of the landlord to accept their offer. And I'll cover that again further on. 10, if the landlord and the residents do reach agreement on that offer, then the tenants have 50 days to wrap up the details, to confirm the financing, do any environmental analysis that's required, the sort of stuff that's normally required in a transaction of any, to sale to anybody. I'm going on to page, so at the bottom of page 2, both sides have a duty to act in faith. That's good faith. That's a requirement under Oregon law as it is now for landlord-tenant matters. Top of page 3, the owner may reject an offer from the residents for any lawful reason. any lawful reason. That includes it's not enough. That includes, I think my car park is worth $50 million and you've offered me five. There is no bureaucratic involvement here of anybody evaluating the value of that park. It's a private market transaction. Again, this is simply requiring a landlord to give the tenants an opportunity to compete to buy the park. The owner is not required to sell the facility to anyone. The owner can withdraw it from the for sale market and decide not to do that. If the tenants make a final offer and the landlord refuses it, deal's off. No further obligation on the landlord. The landlord does act in bad faith. I'm on point 16 of my memo. If the landlord does act in bad faith, and there are experiences in other states where that's happened, then there's a penalty provided in the bill. Similarly, there's a penalty on the tenants because landlords have a fear that some tenants are going to jerk them around just to drive a buyer away. So there's a penalty on the tenants if the tenants do that and act in bad faith. Certain transactions are exempted. They're not treated as sales. For example, a sale within a partnership. So that's an outline of the bill. Let me ask you to look at the other handout of mine, which is the current law. I would note before I run through that, that the current law, which consists of Oregon Revised Statute 90.760 and 90.800 to 840, was adopted by the legislature in 1989, which, not surprisingly, was at another time of park closure crisis and rent increases. And there were significant proposals in the 89 legislature to prevent park closures, to adopt rent control, and to adopt state regulation of park management. And I've looked at the legislative history. All those proposals got pretty far through the system. But the end result was, no, let's encourage park residents to buy their parks. And that's when these statutes got adopted. So I've listed a number of the problems with that current law. These are problems that affect both sides. One of them is that the notice only goes, maybe, it's not clear, notice only goes to tenants if the tenants give the landlord a written, if they form an association. Association has no legal status. It could be you and me deciding we're an association. If the tenant association gives the landlord a written notice saying we want to get notice if you decide to sell. Excuse me, if you list the park. List the park is a specific term. Many landlords sell their parks without ever listing them. So that's not covered. That wasn't anticipated in 89. But if a tenant does, if a tenant association does give the landlord that written notice saying, please let me know, how long does that last? Apparently forever. There's no time limit on it. There's no obligation to renew that. So that's not going to work. In addition, the landlord has a duty to negotiate in good faith with those tenants in that case. How long does that last? Nobody knows. The landlord's, one of the landlord's lawyers in the state has said to landlords that he interprets this provision as a right of first refusal. 3007 is very clearly not a right of first refusal, but the way the current law works probably is. There are other problems that I've described there. There's no penalty for tenants who act in bad faith to mess up deals, etc. So the point again is that to make sure that you understand that we're not doing if doing nothing leaves a problem. Let me emphasize that we went to great lengths to address landlord concerns. We negotiated within the coalition. We negotiated this issue for almost 3 years and almost 20 drafts of that issue. We started in 2010. We produce a draft, which is basically what's in 3007. In January of 2011, I negotiated that draft word for word with the lawyer for the landlords. That draft was to be part of the coalition's 2011 bill. In March of 2011, some landlords said that they didn't understand it. It was too complicated. It had been given to them too late in the process. Those are fair complaints. To be fair, I agreed to take it out of the coalition bill. I expected there would be a commitment from the landlords to negotiate this issue for the 2013 legislature. We started that negotiation in February of 2012. In November of 2012, the landlords said they would not negotiate it further. In that meeting of 2012, one landlord said, no way, no deal, there's nothing you could do on this issue. that would make me, no way you could revise it, that would make me agree to this issue. The landlord leader said, there's nothing in our coalition package for 2013 which is important enough to landlords to make us agree to this issue. In other words, it might have been important enough in 2011, but not in 2013. In 2011, the coalition bill, which passed, it was Senate Bill 772, had a significant landlord issue involving submetering of water in parks.
Who said it?
Just a few other points I want to make. If you have concerns about the specifics of this bill, I'd ask you to send us back to the table. This coalition was created in 1997 when the two sides didn't agree on an issue, abandoned property, abandoned manufactured homes in parks. And then Senator Kenemer said to us, go away and don't come back until you've worked it out. And that coalition has existed since 1997. I'm totally open to working this issue. If it takes until 2014, you all will still be in office. This committee will still exist. I'll be right back here to tell you the compromises that we've tried to make. Why is this important? Resident ownership is not for everybody. We know that. We're not going to have 100% of parks owned by their residents. A lot of people who are in parks are seniors and don't want that responsibility. But it's the only legal and practical way to address three huge problems that park residents have. The first is closure, or just the risk of closure. Seniors can't stand uncertainty, and that risk of closure is scaring them to death. The second is rent increases. We're not ever going to have rent control in Oregon, practically speaking, and yet so landlords can raise their rent. But if you want to control the rents or you want to avoid the risk of closure, the only real way is resident ownership. Same is true for park management issues. The coalition has produced legislation through you all that requires landlords to get training, but you still can't make some people do right, only if the residents own the park themselves. I would note for you that that there's a state policy encouraging this already. It was part of that 1989 package. It's in Section 1 of the bill, right in front of you. It says it's the policy of the state of Oregon to encourage facility residents to participate in the housing marketplace by ensuring that technical assistance, financing opportunities, notice of sale of facilities, and the option to purchase facilities, facilities means parks or marinas, are made available to residents who choose to participate in the purchase of a facility. 18 other states have laws like this, so we're not breaking new ground here. This is the last step of about 10 steps that manufactured housing park advocates have been working on since 2005 to try to address the park closure crisis, which I think someday will come back. Let me conclude by saying that, again, this is an opportunity, this bill proposes an opportunity for residents to compete to purchase the park. Landlords have described this as residents demand rights. I would describe it as residents demand the right to offer landlords a full and fair price for their parks in order to protect their homes. They're not demanding that the landlord sell it to them. That would be a right of first refusal. They're demanding the right to compete. What could be more American than competing in an economic marketplace and letting these people, encouraging these people to do that? One last point. These are communities. The landlords market them as communities, and they are. It's not an apartment building where nobody knows anybody else. People move into these things as communities. One of the parks in my community, my town, Songbrook, and the owner is in the room, and maybe he'll testify later. It's a beautiful park. Residents are very happy. He advertises on the web the following. Songbrook is you, our friends who become family, and there's no other place like it. Our community, our family, is like no other. Now, wouldn't it be the right thing to do to take care of your family when you choose to sell? When you choose to sell your park and take your profit, which is entitled to you, wouldn't it be the right thing to do to let the tenants protect themselves by letting them compete to buy your park? Thank you. Thank you, glad to take questions.
We will take some very quick questions. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh, these are letters. We're not going to read letters today. I know somebody wanted to read a letter, but you can submit those. What did I say?
And Madam Chair, I'd be glad to meet with individual legislators to try to answer
That's
questions.
That's great. 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 people. Colleagues, we are slated to go until 4:45. Can you stay later? Is there anyone who cannot stay later?
Yeah, two down here that can't.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'll stay on. I think the people who came here to testify should get at least as much time as the sponsors of the bill.
I agree. So some of us will be staying on. Do I have a meeting at 5? Anyway, we will stay on.
We've got another committee, so.
Okay. So any questions that you have, I wish they'd be very quick. And what I really prefer would be if you would submit the questions and they will be answered. Obviously, this is our first hearing. This is a big issue. It's been going on for many years, and it's a very important issue for hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of people. Representative Wisnett, did you get your, you will submit a question?
Yes, ma'am. I'll submit to John or to the representative.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Okay. I can submit questions.
Okay. Great.
Good. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. So this is a panel that, you go ahead and get them on the phone. Peter Hanley, Tony Weisbecker, and somebody by phone. Is that Dan Fountain by phone?
Yes, it's
okay.
Dan.
Okay.
Issue, please, gentlemen.
Hello?
Hello. Is this Mr. Fountain?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
So, Mr. Fountain, we have Peter Hanley here and Tony Weisbecker, and then we'll hear from you. We're asking people to keep your statements to 2 minutes, please. And Representative Gomberg, would you time these people, please? And when they have 10 seconds, put up your hand and wave so they see that their time is over. Okay, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Hanley. I'm Executive Director of Community and Shelter Assistance Corporation, also known as CASA of Oregon. I'm here to testify in a technical nature, neither for nor against this building, against this bill. I'm here to discuss what resident ownership is. And so I'm going to go very briefly through a PowerPoint that will go 2 minutes, because you want 2 minutes. So our role in resident ownership is to work with residents to help them purchase the communities that they live in. We work under the auspices of ROC, USA Resident Owns Community, which is a national organization. Our vision is basically to allow residents to purchase their parks. In 1983, New Hampshire was the first organization that began doing resident purchases of manufactured housing parks. 30 years later, they've converted 20% of their parks to resident ownership, representing 103 total conversions. They do have notice and opportunity to purchase, and this bill is designed much like their bill. In October 2006, we saw a lot of park closings. That's when we got into this through some grants through a Corporation for Enterprise Development and Oregon House Community Services, as well as some grants from Meyer Memorial. In 2009, you heard about the legislation that was passed. Our role is to help negotiate a sale. It is to help organize the residents. It is to be the bridge between the residents and the owner to help accomplish those things that need to happen so that the owners are not dealing with a whole bunch of people on a transaction. We are experienced in real estate transactions, having done it for 25 years. We also provide ongoing technical assistance and training to those board members. Since ROC USA started in 2009, 45 communities have been converted, representing almost 3,000 units. You see, yes.
5 seconds.
Oh. Okay. Well, I'll just go through real quick. So here is a park that was going to close. The owner had given notice to the residents, and here is the park today. We had to move most of the most of the units fell apart as we were moving them. You can see the purchase price. All of this is in your packet. So there's the first one. Here's the second one, a senior park in Redmond. Third park, Saunders Creek down in Gold Beach. Vita Lee Park, which the man on the gentleman on the phone will talk about, and then Clackamas Family Park, which Tony will talk about. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chairwoman, members of the Oregon Legislature, I want to thank you for the opportunity to come and speak to you today. My name is Tony Weisbecker. I'm 67 years old. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I'm a native of Wisconsin. You know that. You beat us in the Rose Bowl every year, yeah, handily. I'm a five-year resident of Oregon. I'm a retired business owner, and I am currently a board member of Clackamas River Community Cooperative. We purchased our community from the former landlord in October of last year, and we were fortunate enough to have had a landlord who felt some obligation to the people from whom he gained a very, very substantial income over 25 years. As I was preparing my statement, I could not help but think that if this were 1953 or 1963 or 1973 or even 1983, I wouldn't have to come here today to ask you to support this. It would just be a matter of common business practice with people doing what is right and what is fair and what is just. But it's 2013 and times have changed and things have changed. I do not feel that this bill is restrictive. I've heard that. I do not feel that there's too much red tape. All the people are asking for is an opportunity. I was raised that this was the land of opportunity. I'm hoping it still is. Who are these people that live in these parks? Representative Tomei, I think you made that very, very clear. They're your moms and dads. They're your grandmas and grandpas. They're your aunts and uncles. These are the men who fought in World War II, Korea and Vietnam. These are women who have raised children, taken families and put them together and given them value systems and educated these kids. These are people who deserve to be honored and protected. Again, all that we are asking for is a right to compete. Our community was purchased in October of last year, 5 months. It's been 5 months of hard work, but our financials are in order, and we are at this time well on our way to a successful operation. Thank you for your time, ma'am.
Congratulations. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Fountain.
Yes.
You have something to say to us?
Okay, good afternoon. My name is Dan Fountain. I'm the president of the board of Vita Lee Community Cooperative. I'd like to thank the chairperson and committee for allowing me to speak to you by phone, where traveling is sometimes difficult for me. I'm 60 years old. I'm a fifth-generation Springfield-McKenzie Valley resident. I retired from 30 years as a steel fabricator due to a chronic progressive disease. I've lived at Vita Lee for 10 years. We're located right between Vita and Leeburg on the McKenzie Highway, hence the name Vita Lee. Living on Social Security disability, I was in need of affordable housing. The park has 20 manufactured homes and 13 RV sites. It's a great place to live until it was sold 5 years ago. The new owners immediately raised the rent 10%. 2 years later, nearly another 10%. The new owners did the bare minimum to keep the park up. If anyone asked to have anything done for improvements, the answer was always, okay, good idea, and nothing ever happened. It got to the point that several residents wouldn't even speak to the owners. We bought the park in February 2012. During the first year, we made many needed improvements to the water system, sewage system, drainage system, a lot of tree trimming, brush removal, and as soon as the weather permits, probably July, we'll repave the badly deteriorated roads. It's been a lot of work with the purchase and the construction, but with the much appreciated help from CASA, Rosemary and Julie in particular.
10 seconds, sir.
Yes.
Please finish up.
We pulled it off. I'm just about done. Mm. I've seen a wonderful improvement in the attitude and cooperation from the residents. And once again, this is a good, affordable place to live. I hope through this legislation that others may have the opportunity that we have, affordable and secure housing. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I always try to, thank you very much. I always try to have people come up who live more than 100 miles away. Is Newport more than 100 miles away from here?
Yes.
Okay. We'll have Mr. Doug Fitz. Robert Danielson, is Wood Village 100 miles away?
No.
It's over 50 miles.
What? What we have is over 100 miles. Most of us live more than 50 miles away. And Mr. Richard Delaney from Burlingame, California? Is he here? Come on up, sir. Okay, and so then I will call on Al Baker.
So while they're coming up, Madam Chair, you've given me the worst job in the room, haven't you?
I know, I did. And Tom Mitchell, you're welcome to come up, but I'm not going to let you read the letter. You can submit the letter, but you're welcome to speak. Did you have Barbara Mitchell with you?
I'm going to speak in place of Barbara Mitchell.
You come on up. Okay, go ahead, sir. You've got 2 minutes. I'm sorry.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Delaney. I am a real estate broker in San Bruno, California. I sell and manage mobile home parks in 6 states, including Oregon and Florida. I currently manage 20 in Oregon and 2 in Florida. In my job, I come across daily people who own parks and people who live in parks. My experience in Florida shows that this kind of legislation has caused more problems than it has solved. The Florida law is less restrictive than the proposed HB 3007, yet the first deal I closed took 1 year. The second deal I closed took 6 months. In general, the problems are increased litigation. There's a group of lawyers who nitpick the wording, things like honest choice, things like fairly negotiate, things like penalties, and that ties things up. It increases the cost to the state. The state has to administer it. It increases the cost to park residents. It increases the cost to park owners. And it has resulted in increased foreclosures. I think that there's documentation from representatives, a lawyer, and 2 real estate brokers in Florida. I'd like to have you take a look at that and read that at your convenience. I've read House Bill 3007, and it seems to me that it should be rejected. It attempts to solve a problem that does not exist. Many believe that is unconstitutional because it takes from one group and gives it to another. Some rights from one group and giving it to another. At a minimum, it would severely restrict the capital investment coming to Oregon. There's nothing more portable than money. And the people who invest know to stay away from problems. I believe that this House bill should be rejected.
Thank you, Mr. Delaney. Go ahead, sir. You've got 2 minutes.
Okay. Madam Chairman and committee members, my name is Al Baker. I live in a park in Aloha, Oregon, Seminole Estates, that is between Beaverton and Hillsborough. And I have lived in that park for 16 years. My representative is Joe Glios. In 1980, my parents moved into a mobile home park, which also happened to be in Aloha, but it's different to mine. They were in their 60s, and this was to be their final home. After 5 happy years there, they were shocked to receive a letter from their owner's attorney that gave them 6 months to get out because the park was being developed into a shopping center. A quick check around the area showed there was no available places to move their home, and the result was that they practically gave away their home, which they had paid over $20,000 for. They got $2,000 for it. It was a devastating financial blow, as they had spent most of their money that they had available to purchase that home. As I said, I live in a different mobile home park in Alloa. In 2002, there were 11 mobile home parks within a four-mile radius of my park, 11. Just 4 years later, in 2006, there were just three left. Yes, 8 out of 11 parks have been closed for redevelopment. Do I need to explain how that struck a terror, or even a great fear, into the hearts of the residents in our park? Any available spaces in our park were quickly taken. Any available spaces around other places were quickly taken. Many hundreds of residents had to find their homes and process. And in the process, they experience heavy financial losses. Once a park is condemned, the homes therein become essentially worthless and typically cannot be moved. In 2006, we, the residents, tried to purchase our park, but the owners would not sell. Can you understand that we in our park actually dread the thought of an improving economy, as that will surely increase the likelihood that our park will be also sold for redevelopment? Yes, we are thankful for the legislation which has been passed since that time. The legislation is somewhat helpful, but in reality, it's only a small amount of help.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. I'm sorry, your time is up. Okay. Sorry, you can submit your written materials.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, now I think we have Mr. Mitchell.
Yeah, my name's Tom Mitchell, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3007. My wife, Barbara Mitchell, and I are residents of Lake Ridge Mobile Home Park in Eugene. I'm president of the Lake Ridge Committee of Seven, and wife Barbara is president of the Lake Ridge Chapter of OSTA. Nancy Nathanson and others have been at work trying to pass this bill, and we're here to support it. As Oregon's economy improves, there will be more pressure to sell existing manufactured home parks for other development purposes. All that we and other supporters of House Bill 3007 ask is to provide residents an equal opportunity to purchase our facilities. There are a number of items on here that I could go into. Obviously, I won't have time. Just to summarize this, we urge you to pass this bill to provide residents an equal opportunity to purchase our facilities. I would also like to add that Michael Whitty, who asked me to read his statement, he will not be able to be here because he's giving a course on Park Managers Association in Ontario here tomorrow. All I want to say in summarizing his observations about this bill is that he strongly supports passing of this bill.
Thank you so much. Thank you, panel. And we're going to call up, let's see, there was one gentleman, Doug Fitz from Newport, and Chuck Carpenter and Lauren Landau. After that, we will call up Kim Berry and
Marianne
Bradley.
I'm Doug Fitz. I own a mobile home park in Newport, Oregon, and my wife and I have run this for 37 years. So I think we have a handle on it now. Madam, do you mind if I ask a question of the committee?
Well, we're here to hear what you
It'll
have
be a
to
quick
say,
one.
Sir.
Does anybody own the house rentals, apartment rentals, condominiums?
Yes.
One?
Well, I do.
I own one.
Okay. What I'd like to do is reverse this bill into your pocket. Now, this bill is just for houses, house rentals, apartments. Now, would you like to wait 30 days before you ever have a commitment to whether they're even interested?
Madam Chair, he's putting pressure on me.
Okay.
Okay.
Then,
we're here to hear your statement.
Then after that, we have another 70 days before they make up.
No.
Okay. I don't think this is fair to anybody to have to wait that long, especially if you're working on a 1031 exchange. And if any of the residents in my park come to me today and wanted to buy it, I'd make a deal with them. They couldn't refuse it. It'd be what the county has it appraised at. So I have no objection to that. It's just drawing this out for all this time. It's just too long. So I wish you'd really consider, you know, how it would affect you if you did own property and it was on your Well, your watch there, because you can't do anything with a 1031 this way. So that's about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thanks for coming today.
Madam Chair, back to us. Mr. Fitz, where is your park?
Newport.
Where in Newport?
It's in your committee.
I know, but where in Newport?
On 3rd Street, right by the Miami Beach turnaround down right. In that area.
Thank you.
Yeah. Beautiful area.
The only thing is, we've had 5 vacancies in the last 3-4 years that we can't fill, and this has never happened in that many years.
Mr. Danielson, who is Mr. Danielson?
Mr. Daniels.
Didn't I call you up? Wood Village, right?
Yes.
That's right. We figured that wasn't 100 miles. Go ahead. You have 2 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. I'm with Wood Village. I've been in a family business for many, many years. We've had parks that we've built and maintained for 30-plus years. The part, I guess, that mainly concerns me, a couple things that were mentioned, is the fact of the maintenance, ongoing maintenance issues and so on, because those are always things that come up, and that for length of time, that's the main thing that you're looking ahead to plan for those issues. And I think sometimes where it goes to the tenants, they're not prepared to be able to deal with some of that. I have a couple short letter, just little pieces that I wanted to read from a couple tenants that we have that said there would be fighting between the tenants, constantly over rules and regulations, favoritism between the tenants. The reason, and I've got a couple that kind of say that, we've had recently a tenant that caused lots of problems for their neighbor, and we've spent quite a bit of money to get them out, and that's one of the things too that the neighbors have been are concerned about, because ongoing with that, where they'd have to deal with their neighbors and under that scenario. And then the other thing too is, it says, I would certainly not want to put any money into a long-term commitment. The stress and worry would be unhealthy for me, and I do not want to own part of a business anymore. And that is ultimately what it is a business. If you guys, any of you are in a business, you know how challenging that is with one or two, but have 50 or 100, and I think it would add to the complexity immensely.
Thank you very much. Okay, who's next?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would respectfully ask that I have a little bit more time. I'm the counterpart to John Van Landingham and the landlord-tenant coalition.
We'll give you 4 minutes, sir.
4 minutes, and he had 20 minutes. Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of things. First of all, park closure is not an issue in Oregon. And I want to clarify, I've been on the coalition since 1999. I've negotiated against John Van Landingham every coalition bill that we've produced to this body since 1999, and we've done a lot of good work. I think you're seeing here today why it's important to have a coalition and why the issues need to be resolved in coalition. But just because we've done good work in the past does not mean that there are issues that simply cannot be resolved. And this is an issue that cannot be resolved. First of all, park closure is not an issue right now, and it probably will not be into the future. Rent increases, certainly residents want to be protected from rent increases, but when a park converts to a resident-owned, publicly subsidized community, they're faced with rent increases that range from $75 to $100 to $125. And I propose to this committee that if a landlord in this state ever gave their community that kind of a rent increase, we would be on the front page of the Oregonian, and we would be sitting here today. So I would ask you to keep that in mind. And as far as manager training goes, the reports that we hear back from resident communities and from communities in New Hampshire is that infighting currently exists. You can never get away from it in most cases. It's almost as if it's indigenous in the human nature. So if it's not a landlord-tenant situation, then it is a committee running the community in which they are upsetting other people in the community. And finally, I'd like to just say to the comment that residents are Vietnam veterans and World War II veterans and farmers and all these other things. So are community owners. And these are the people that provide the affordable housing that you all complain about so much. Parks are closing in this state every year, but it's a little bit at a time. It's an abandonment here, it's an abandonment there. You all sit here and say you want more affordable housing, but you don't listen to the landlords when we tell you that there's issues in terms of the tax code that forces people to simply destroy good housing. You don't listen to it. You don't want to address the tax code, the fact that a landlord cannot purchase an abandoned home in their community if the taxes are exceed that of what the actual value of the home is. And very often that is what's happening. Seniors are deferring their taxes for 20 years. The home will have $15,000 in taxes owed on it and may only be worth $5,000. Are you going to buy a $5,000 home and pay $15,000 in taxes? But you won't help us with those issues. And yet, you sit here and you talk about affordable housing. Let me tell you, House Bill 3007 does nothing to protect affordable housing. It does nothing to protect residents when rents are increasing at the rate they do when these homes are purchased. And a report that I have provided to this committee, which has just come out, in the state of New Hampshire, communities are going to the state legislature asking for $7 million in reimbursements so that the communities can stay viable because they have no way to pay for the infrastructure improvements that are necessary. It's in the report that I've submitted to you, and I really encourage you to take a look at that report because we're foisting on to residents a deal that is really a bad deal. We're loading them up with a bunch of debt. We're taking communities and valuing them and putting a loan out for 110%, 115% of the value of that community. And then we're asking the most vulnerable people in our state to pay for it. And, oh, by the way, if you run out of money to take care of that $600,000 sewer repair, you're out of luck. And those people, at some point, will be coming to this committee asking for funding. Look at the data. Look at what is happening in New Hampshire. There's over 25% of the communities in New Hampshire that are in the resident program that we all say is such a great program are petitioning the legislature for funding. And they're all listed in there, the names of those communities, where those communities are located, and what they're asking for. And they're asking for $150,000 for a retaining wall or $600,000 for a septic system. So those are all things you need to take into account. I think we would all love to have people have home ownership. I mean, my God, over the last 10 years, that was our mantra. And where did it get us? It got us into a financial crisis in the last 8 years with people up to debt, up to their eyeballs in debt, unable to pay for it, and coming back to the government and saying, poor me, I made a bad decision. We are setting people up for a catastrophe. It is not affordable housing if you're going to take and load them up, people up with debt that they cannot possibly afford to pay back. It doesn't work.
Sorry, 10 seconds.
So that's my plea. If you want to talk about affordable housing, there's a lot we can talk about. And I've mentioned these things to you in the committee before. But you're not listening. I mean, there are homes being thrown out every day that are good, affordable housing that you seem to be blind to. Thank you.
Mr. Carpenter. Go ahead, sir.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lauren Landau. Having sat here and listened to some of the different testimony, everything I've written down on this paper seems to not necessarily apply, but I am a park owner here in Oregon. I am a partner in a property management company that manages about 90 communities representing about 10,000 home sites. And I am a broker who's been involved in hundreds of sales to manufactured housing communities, none of which have resulted in park closure. And it's an honor to speak with you today regarding House Bill 3007 and asking that you, urging you to stand against it, as it would have a far-reaching negative impact on our industry and actually private property rights within the state. I have had the opportunity as a broker to sell a community to the tenants, and as funding and grants have presented themselves, it's become a greater opportunity for the tenants to do so, as Vitali and Clackamas River Village show you. But that's being done without the need for this restrictive new legislation that does provide a right of first refusal. I'm hard-pressed to figure out what else it's doing when the tenants have the first right to make an offer. In real estate, that right of first refusal typically goes to individuals who are ready and willing buyers. It's paid for typically, but the tenants represent neither a ready or, in many cases, a willing buyer. They move into the communities with full knowledge that they are leasing the land their home is placed on. The bill itself actually recognizes the negative impact of value because it calls for a 10% of the sales price a penalty for bad faith on the part of the landlords and bad faith on the part of the tenants is just the ability to not conform with the bill. So therefore, I can only deduct that they must believe that the value decrease is 10% of the property, and I would argue it would be even more given the time delays that would be caused, and as Rich Delaney had pointed out, the 1031 investors would be blocked out of the market when a park initially comes up for sale.
Sorry, 10 seconds.
Yeah, thank you. I'll finish with saying this, is that I've heard it said, and I agree, that House Bill 3007 is a legislative solution looking for a problem. Manufactured housing is the only form of non-government subsidized affordable housing because the tenants and landlords share in the cost of the housing. I just would ask that you would vote no on House Bill 3007. Thanks.
Thank you so much. We have a J.H. Thank you all for coming. J.H. Whale, Kim Berry, and Marianne Gratt. Thank you for coming today. Did I call him twice? Are there two people with mustaches
no,
like that?
No, I was just giving them my letter.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, I'm going. I'm Kim Berry. I own, operate, manage, and sell mobile home parks in the state of Oregon. H-Bill 3007 will end all capital improvements to the much-needed capital improvements that are needed in the state of Oregon. The vast majority of the 1,200 mobile home parks in Oregon were built in the 1960s. That means the sewer, the water, the wells, the houses, the roads are in dire need of major repairs in a vast majority of the mobile home parks in Oregon. Some houses in mobile home parks sell for $180,000. Some, the majority of them, sell for about $10,000 each. We know that if this passes, investors will not invest their hard-earned money into mobile home parks to renovate them in the state of Oregon. That is what we need desperately. Mobile home parks are not closing. There is no way they are closing. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you know this, but if you do decide to close a mobile home park, you have to pay the tenants. $10,000 on average, it depends, and then give them a year to move. They don't close. We don't want parks to close. We don't want parks to close. Nobody wants that at all. We want to preserve this housing. I personally have put my hard money, time, energy, and life into renovating three mobile home parks where there were drug dealers next to seniors. Drug dealer, a vacant house, abandoned house, disgusting. Now they are safe, wonderful places for people to live. Otherwise, that park would have been slowly demolished, slowly the tenants would have moved out because it was disgusting, and sold to Fred Meyers right next door. There's no doubt about that. I, and along with many, many other people, will never do that again in the state of Oregon if this goes into effect, and those parks will diminish and fall into the ground and go to the drug dealers and the worst places where they should be the best places in the state to live. They're the best low-income housing. As far as rents go, the average rent in the state of Oregon is $375 a month, including water, sewer, and garbage. It's gone up since 1970, slower than the rate of inflation, less than 2% per year. There's no way that we are, you know, raking these tenants over the coals. There's absolutely no way. A septic system that failed recently, $600,000 for 40 people to connect it to sewer. The requirement. That is what you're going to put these tenants into if tenants start buying a ton of these properties, because nobody else will buy the bad properties. If tenants start buying the whatever properties they do buy, the investors will not buy the others at the risk of being sued because you didn't act in good faith if you sold the property to somebody else. It will stop the sale of low-income housing in the state of Oregon, where people do put their hard-earned money, time, energy, and emotion into saving these parks and saving these houses. Nobody else...
Sorry, we're out of time.
But thank you, Kim.
It will diminish low-income housing in the state of Oregon.
We have about 1 minute.
Just a really quick question.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm trying to this issue's new to me. I'm trying to understand the rationale behind investors not wanting to invest if this goes into effect.
Because, for instance, this year, a person who's owned mobile home parks since 1934, his family has done this. They've seen the ups and downs. They're not rich by any means. They needed to sell in 5 days. So they approached me and said, Kim, we need to sell this now for a family emergency. Mm-hmm. They sold it. We closed it. It was done. They were happy. I would not invest in Oregon again if this was the case. If I had to wait and wait for 60, 90 days.
The timing issue.
Not only the timing, but also I want to sell when I need to sell. I need to sell it right away, you know, potentially. And also, I don't mind if tenants buy properties, but demand it that they do. There's a company that's pushing this. They get paid very well to do this, and I don't think the tenants realize the risk that they're being put under. $90,000, $150,000 to replace roads, $60,000 for a septic system, $250,000 for water systems. They should be fully aware of these problems, and nobody in the world can tell you when a septic system is going to fail. Nobody.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
And I think that some of these people are local. I've seen you in the building, Kim, haven't I?
Yeah.
And so these people might be willing to meet with you or meet in your district office. So I assume most of the people here, you have these little yellow buttons, and I assume you're all opposed to this bill. Is that correct? Okay, I just want to make sure we're covering bases. Very quickly.
I was wondering, since we are going to have to leave, how many of them are opposed out in the audience? Or
I think all of them with the yellow buttons are opposed.
Could we just count them? 1, 2, 3, 4.
Excuse me, Madam Chair,
yes.
Are we at the end of our witness list?
Yes.
I wonder if I could impose on Mr. Carpenter for a quick question.
I'm going to end in 1 minute.
All right.
So, can you meet with them offline, please?
Okay.
Would that be okay?
Thank you. Ask it. Go ahead. Quick.
I think I'm the chair here. Thank you. Could you ask it offline, please?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Okay. Okay, we have okay, with that, we're going to close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Yes.
Hey, Dave. Let's take some...